It said that when the Buddha, before he was a Buddha, when he was still living his life as a prince, living in the palaces of in the foothills of the Himalayas, he lived a very protected life. And he didn't have much encounter with the great sufferings that people encounter in life. It said his father kept him protected from, very well protected from, ever seeing a sick person or an old person or a dead person. And it was kind of like growing up in the suburbs. And in fact, the first dead person I saw, the first corpse I ever saw in my life, was when I was 11 years old, was in Nepal, which is the place where the Buddha was kept protected from it all. I saw a child. I didn't actually see the body so well because the child was wrapped in cloth. It was being carried on a stretcher down to the river where they were going to have the pyre that burned the body. And so the Buddha was kept protected from seeing these things. And then, as young people might be inclined to do if they've kind of kept cooped up, at some point he ventured forth beyond the palace walls. And for the first time in his life, he encountered a sick person, an old person, and a dead person. And this had a very big impact on him. He asked the person he was with, his attendant, "What is that? What is that?" You know, "You've never seen a sick person." "Oh, that's a sick person." And the person explained, "It's the fate of everyone, sooner or later they get sick." "What's that?" "Oh, it's an old person. Sooner or later, unless, you know, if nature takes its normal course, everyone gets old like that." And back in ancient India, 2,500 years ago, old age didn't have, they didn't have plastic surgery, and they didn't have cosmetics, and they didn't have dentists in the way we have them. So you can imagine, you know, the age showed much more, perhaps, than sometimes we see it here in the modern West, where we say we have a youth culture. And then he saw a corpse. He said, "What's that?" And his attendant said, "Oh, that's a dead person, and sooner or later everyone will die, including you." And this impact of seeing firsthand sickness, old age, and death was so strong in the psyche of the Buddha that he decided to leave the life that he was set to become a king and follow the family business. And became a renunciant, left all that behind in order to seek for some deeper answers, not just answers, but transformation in the context of this life that we live, where sickness, old age, and death is a common part of our life. And he wanted to find some answer to the suffering that entailed. And you can maybe imagine someone who, until they were maybe 28, 29 years old, lived a very protected life, the shock of kind of the protection, the barriers of that protection being dropped down, and then seeing life for the first time very dramatically, and how very motivating that experience might be. And so it was for the Buddha. So this encounter with death then motivated him to engage in the spiritual life, in the spiritual practice, to seek and try to find that which brings peace and freedom in the context of this kind of life that we live. Many years later, after he had discovered what that peace is, how to have this, to have a kind of deep, abiding sense of well-being or peace in the midst of this world of transiency, of suffering, of death, he was visited by a woman who had lost her only son. And I'd like to read you that story. It's a very famous story. And I think all the pieces of the story are significant. Gotami was her family name, but because she tired easily, she was called Kisa Gotami, or Frail Gotami. She had been born at Savati in a poverty-stricken house. When she grew up, she married, going to the house of her husband's family to live. There, because she was a daughter of a poverty-stricken house, they treated her with contempt. After a time, she gave birth to a son. Then they accorded her respect. And this is quite common in ancient India, that a woman's status was really in relationship to the men around, and you enter a family because you married into the family, your status in the family is very much dependent on having mostly a son back in those times. But when that boy of hers was old enough to play and run hither and about, he died. Sorrow sprang up within her, thought she. Since the birth of my son, I, who was once denied honor and respect in this very house, have received respect. These folk may even seek to cast my son away. Taking her son on her hip, she went about from one house door to another, saying, "Give me medicine for my son." Wherever people encountered her, they said, "Where did you ever meet with medicine for the dead?" So saying, they clapped their hands and laughed in derision. She had not the slightest idea what they meant. Now a certain wise man saw her and thought, "This woman must have been driven out of her mind by sorrow for her son. But medicine for her, no one else is likely to know except the Buddha." So he said to her, "Woman, as for medicine for your son, there is no one else who knows but the Buddha. Go to him and ask." "The man speaks the truth," thought she. Taking her son on her hip, she took her stand in the outer circle of the congregation around the seated Buddha and said, "O Buddha, give me medicine for my son." The teacher, seeing that she was ripe for understanding, said, You did well, Gotami, in coming hither for medicine. Go enter the city. Make the rounds of the entire city, beginning at the beginning. In whatever house no one has ever died, from that house fetch tiny grains of mustard seed." Every house in India has mustard seeds, part of the cooking. "Well, very well, Reverend Sir," said she. Delighted in heart, she entered within the city, and at the very first house, she said, "The Buddha bids me fetch tiny grains of mustard seed for medicine for my son. Give me tiny grains of mustard seed." "Alas, Gotami," said they, and brought and gave to her. "This particular seed I cannot take. In this house, someone has died." "What say you, Gotami? Here it is impossible to count the number of people who have died." "Well then, enough. I'll not take it. The Buddha did not tell me to take mustard seed from a house where anyone has ever died. In the same way, she went to the second house and to the third house and the fourth. Finally, she understood. In the entire city, this must be the way. The Buddha, full of compassion for the welfare of everyone, must have seen. Overcome with emotion, she went outside the city, carried her son to the burning ground, and holding him in her arms, said, "Dear little son, I thought that you alone had been overtaken by this thing, which people call death. But you are not the only one death has overtaken. This is a law common to everyone." So saying, she cast her son away in the burning ground. Then she uttered the following verse. "No village law, no law of market town, no law of a single house is this. Of all the world and all the worlds of gods, this only is the law that all things are impermanent." So the story of a woman who, in a sense, goes a little bit crazy with her grief. And you can imagine, partly because of the tremendous meaning it meant to have a son in that context. She was poor, no status, maybe in danger of being driven out of the house. She had probably tremendous love for her son. He was lost. She refused to believe he had died, or refused to believe she had to let go of him, until somehow she realized the universality of death. That's something we all face. It's part of everybody's life. And then the question is, and you know, in some ways, this story is a parable, not only for our encounter with death and coming to some kind of acceptance of death as part of life, but also it's a parable for any kind of loss that we have in our life. Are we still holding on to things that are long gone, trying to relive or keep in place something which will never come back again? Are we holding on to anger unnecessarily because of what we've lost or what's been taken away from us? We hold on to grief unnecessarily. There might be a time for anger and a time for grief, but are there ways that we hold on to it because we don't want to accept what's happening? I like to distinguish the difference between anger and resentment, as resentment is frozen anger. We're holding on to it. We're not willing to let go of the situation or accept it in some deep way. Or I like the little quote that's kind of cliche, that forgiveness is giving up all hope for a better past. You're holding on for a better past, trying to construct a better past to make the past better. There are wise ways and unwise ways of relating to the past, but here, this parable, at least as a parable, is someone who's holding on to the past, holding on to something she doesn't want to let go, she doesn't want to accept. So what do we hold on to? What are we not willing to let go of and move on in our life and meet the next moment free or more awake? When I was, many years ago, I went to one of the offshoots, not tributary, I guess the offshoots of the Amazon River. There's in French Guiana, which borders Brazil, it was actually the river, we went up one of these rivers that borders actually French Guiana and Suriname. And we went far up the river to a place where people seldom go. And we came across a village of African Americans. And the story, they're called the Boni, very proud people. And they had been taken to Suriname in maybe the 1700s to be slaves. And in the first generation, well, they, you know, the people who had been captured in Africa and taken to be enslaved, they escaped from slavery. And they went deep into the jungles where they couldn't be found, where they were left alone. And they kind of created a kind of friendship with the Indians there, and they actually taught the Indians how to make canoes. They knew how to make canoes, but the natives there didn't. But they retained their culture, and paradoxically, or oddly enough, they're kind of more African than people in Africa, in the sense that they maintain many of the traditional religious ideas and values and customs, kind of untouched by much of modern world. So we encountered this wonderful village of people. And the day we got there, an old woman in the village had died. And as we entered the village, this big workshop area, they were building her coffin, and they were building it around her. You know, she was just laying there on the planks, and they were building this coffin around her. So we watched for a while, and we went about. And that evening, they were going to have a festival, a ceremony, a ritual, a funeral ceremony for her. And it was very interesting the way they conducted it. In the center of the village, they had this kind of ceremonial hall that had no walls, just big posts kind of, and a thatched roof. And they were going to carry the coffin up there to this place to celebrate or perform the ceremonies. And there were, I think, as I remember, six older men of the village carrying the coffin up the road. And when they came to the entryway of this ceremonial hall, there was an old man waiting. And as they tried to enter the entryway, he started pushing back on the coffin and pounding on it, and in some language I couldn't understand, yelling. It sounded like swearing at the coffin and hitting it, and, you know, being really angry. And so obviously he was angry, and, you know. And that went on for a while, and then he stopped, but he refused to let the coffin in. And then he changed place with another man, older man, carrying the coffin. And the other guy stood in front and did the same thing, yelling. And so then I asked someone who spoke English, what's going on here? And it was explained that these are the old men of the village. She was an older woman. She's an old woman. They were friends of they grew up together. They were kind of in the village since they were children, and they knew each other really well in all kinds of ways in which you spend your whole life growing up together. Maybe some of them had been lovers with her and all kinds of things. And they were getting off their chest the things they had to get off their chest before they were ready to celebrate her life and her passing away. And they were kind of expressing themselves, letting her know, you know, remember that time. And once they kind of said it all, then they finally let the coffin into the ceremonial hall. And the rest of the night, through the whole night, the village just danced. They boogied around the coffin. Music and dancing was quite, you know, festive occasion. But before the festivities could happen, they had to have this little kind of letting go of the resentment, the holding, the things that they've been never told her, but they felt they should have said in order to allow it to move on. So that's one way of, you know, one cultural way of dealing with death. Here in the modern world, the kind of funerals and memorial services I've been to, they tend to be much more sedate compared to that. But how is it we relate to people who are dying, and how do we release them? One of the customs in Buddhism is as someone who is dying, or once they've died, especially once they've kind of, you know, had their last breath, there's a practice, a kind of inner practice, of releasing that person from any holding you hold to, holding on to them. They're going through this huge transition. And it's said, and since you kind of, if you're still kind of grab onto it and refusing to allow them to go, in your mind at least, like this woman is refusing to let them go, that you kind of actually make it harder for the person to go into that transition of dying. And so there's this inner practice then of finding inside of you the ability to let go. Okay, I let you go. I'm not going to hold on to you. It's okay, please go, you know. And we send people off with kindness and with our goodwill. A very important story, or a myth, legend in Buddhism, is that of a disciple of the Buddha named Moggallana. And Moggallana's mother, who he was very close to, died. And after she died, he had a series of dreams where he dreamed that she was reborn in kind of this hell realm where she was a hungry ghost. And it was a very difficult hell realm where hungry ghosts have difficulty anyway, because they have these beings with huge, 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 huge bellies. But their throats are amazingly thin. And so no matter how much you can eat, you can't get food down your throat fast enough to satisfy this huge belly, which is always hungry. So hungry ghosts are always hungry, never satisfied. And some people are like that. You see them. You can never give them enough. They always want more. And maybe you feel, you yourself or sometimes feel like hungry ghosts. But there's this idea that she was reborn as a hungry ghost. And in a particular place where every time there, not only was she a hungry ghost with this kind of throat, but every time she took a bite of solid food to eat, it turned to flames in her mouth. And every time she tried to drink something, it turned to blood and to pus. So he has again these dreams, and he has his mother, so he's quite horrified, you know, disturbed by it. So he goes to the Buddha and explains he has his dreams, and the Buddha says, oh yes, you're actually seeing what's going on with your mother, but you can help her. And what you need to do is to, I forget exactly how the story goes, but you need to do some acts of goodness in the world. Make some offerings, do some good deed in the world. And then when you've done that, then dedicate the goodness of that, the merit of that, for the welfare of your mother. And that'll help release her from that particular state of life, the state of rebirth or whatever, and help her move on. And then it said that Moggallana went and descended into the hell realms and came to the gate of her particular hell, and he broke open the lock. And all the beings in that hell realm, all those hungry ghosts, were able to escape, and they came up to the world of humans. And so the people that were aware of this then gathered together and made all these food offerings and offerings of merit to these hungry ghosts, encouraging them to go wherever they needed to go back to where they came from, if they needed, because they need to kind of live out their kind of their karma down there, I suppose. Moggallana's mother was released once and for all and found some kind of freedom. But In order to get these beings to go back where they belonged, I think there was kind of a pact set up with these hungry ghosts in this hell that every year, on the seventh month, they would be allowed to leave their hell realms, and the people would feed them and offer their kindness and their merit and their goodness to them and the respect to these beings that have passed away, these hungry ghosts. So what you find in Japan and in China to this day, right here in the peninsula, you find it in some of the Japanese Buddhist... have you ever been to Obon ceremony at the Japanese temples nearby? Well, the Obon ceremony is celebrating this particular story. And they're kind of festive, right, aren't they? But they're kind of celebrating the story. And on the usually it's considered the seventh month of the year is when all these hungry ghosts come visit. And so that month, you're supposed to put all this extra food out on the altar and do all these wonderful things for these hungry ghosts and the goblins and all these things. Here in America, July doesn't mean much for us in terms of hungry ghosts and goblins. In America, the ghosts and the goblins, they tend to come out wherever they come from. I don't know where they come from. But they tend to come out in October, the end of October. And because of that, the Buddhist groups that do this ceremony, like the San Francisco Zen Center, for example, and some other that I know, will celebrate the Sagaki ceremony, the ceremony for feeding the hungry ghosts, on around Halloween or on Halloween. But they don't do it just as a kind of way of feeding the hungry ghosts. They do it as a very respectful, reverent way of remembering those beings, those people we know who have passed in the last year. And often they evoke their names. They do some chanting for them. They make some offerings to them. They offer them light. They offer them food. And the idea is partly to offer kind of, you know, some kind of memorial service. It's also often very helpful for the psyche, for people, for us, to remember people who've passed away and to honor that memory and honor the goodness of that person or the good memories or just remember who they are. As just seems like a wonderful thing to do at times for the psyche. And also as a way of helping us release any way in which we're still holding on to that person or the memory of that person or holding on to the grief or not really haven't really fully accepted that this is what's happened in our life. And so I think for every individual person that goes through this Sagaki ceremony, where it's kind of a memorial service, it has a different meaning for each person depending on what needs to be done. For some people, it is very much kind of a memorial service and a release of that person or sending our goodwill to that person who's died. For some people, it's more visitation of their own hungry ghost in their own psyche and having that remembering that, recognizing the demons, the goblins inside themselves, and somehow being very respectful and kind to those, in contrast to the way we sometimes can be towards the part of ourselves which we're uncomfortable with, we don't want to accept, and we don't want to admit that's there. And this is a time then to kind of let it come up, in a sense, in a very generous way, in a very respectful way, in a kind way, in a way that's not going to cause suffering for other beings, to remember it. And then and then they say, you know, to offer light, to offer food, but to offer something, offer our goodness to that, a respectful context, a friendly context for it all. So what I'd like to do with all of you is to lead you in a little ritual that's also kind of a guided meditation. And what it'll be is mostly a guided meditation on loving-kindness meditation. Loving-kindness is the practice of offering our goodwill, our kindness, our well-wishing for others. And that at some point in the middle of this guided meditation, I'll invite you all to name someone that you know who's died in recent times, in the last year or something, you know, some recent time, and just to bring up their name in the middle of this ritual, this ceremony, this commemoration, this meditation. And then we'll do that for a while, say names, and then I'll continue then offering loving kindness. And that loving kindness then will be offered to those names, those people, as their names have come up. Does that seem okay with all of you? So, make yourselves comfortable in an upright posture. And before we do the loving kindness meditation, I'm going to do some Pali chants, some chants in the ancient language of the Buddha. And you can just include this as part of your meditation to listen to this. So sitting upright, gently closing your eyes. And letting your mind be at ease the best you can, letting your heart be at ease. Taking a few moments to feel your breathing. Breathing in and breathing out. And a little bit, letting your mind become still and quiet. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddham saranam gacchami. Dhammam saranam gacchami. Sangham saranam gacchami. Dutiyampi Buddham saranam gacchami. Dutiyampi Dhammam saranam gacchami. Dutiyampi Sangham saranam gacchami. Tatiyampi Buddham saranam gacchami. Tatiyampi Dhammam saranam gacchami. Tatiyampi Sangham saranam gacchami. Anicca vata sankara upaduva yodamino upakito aneru chanti tesang vipassamo sukho. All things are impermanent. They have the nature of arising and passing away. The quieting, the peacefulness of all the activity of the mind is the greatest happiness. So bringing your attention to the area around your heart and feeling whatever sensations might be in that area. And then have your breathing move in and out. Move through the heart center. Almost like you're imagining you're breathing through that part of your body. And having a sense of yourself sitting here. A respectful awareness of yourself. and offer yourself some thoughts of goodwill, wishing yourself well, thinking kindly of yourself. Perhaps you can even be happy with yourself. And then I'll give you the classic Buddhist phrases of loving kindness. And then silently in your own mind, you can repeat these phrases. And as you repeat them, see if you can sink into the intention, the meaning, the motivation that might give rise to these wishes. May I be happy. So each of you say that for yourself. May I be happy. May I be safe. May I be healthy. May I be at ease. Breathing in and out through your heart. Saying again, may I be happy. May I be safe. May I be healthy. May I be at ease. And then bring to mind someone who is a benefactor for you. It could be someone who cares about you quite a bit or has helped you somewhere in your life. Or it could be someone who inspires you, like maybe some people I know take the Dalai Lama as a benefactor. Or some person. And kind of get a sense of this person, this benefactor. Maybe an image of them in front of you or a sense of their presence. Reminding yourself of their capacity to be happy. That they have that potential. And that wouldn't it be great if they fulfilled that potential? Wouldn't it be great if they could be happy? And then repeat these words, extending this intention of goodwill towards this person. May you be happy. May you be safe. May you be healthy. May you be at ease. And again for the same person. Maybe now imagining how you would feel a little bit if you knew that they were happy. Or how you'd feel receiving their kindness from them. May you be happy. May you be safe. May you be healthy. May you be at ease. And now bring to mind someone that you know who has died in recent times, or someone you've learned about who has died. And it'd be best if it'd be someone you bring to mind for whom it doesn't bring a lot of grief at this moment. And then remembering this person. And offer your kindness, offer your goodwill to this person. By being willing to release the person from any holding you have. And by extending your kindness, may you be happy. May you be safe. May you be healthy. May you be at ease. And now I invite you to speak out loud the name or names of people you've known who have passed away in recent times. And it can just be spontaneously as you want to, and it's fine to have two or three people saying names at the same time. Just quietly saying it out loud. And I'll start with Marty Martyr. And Anagarika Munindra, and my friend Butch, rich gold. And then we offer the merit of our practice and of our efforts, of our kindness. We offer whatever benefits that come from our offer of loving kindness to others. We offer our compassion, our care for those who have passed and for those who still live. May all beings be happy. May all beings be safe. May all beings be healthy. May all beings be at ease. May all the unresolved tensions and pains, frustrations and sorrows, that we carry within us. May all the hungry ghosts and demons and fears that we carry, may they be at ease. May they find their way to feeling safe and to relax, to liberation. And then one tradition is at the end of a ceremony like this, there's this following discourse of the Buddha which is recited. It's called the Great Discourse on Blessings. To associate not with the foolish, but to be with the wise, to honor the worthy ones, this is the blessing supreme. To reside in a suitable location, to have good past deeds done and set oneself in the right direction, this is a blessing supreme. To be well spoken, highly trained, well educated, skilled in handicraft, and highly disciplined, this is a blessing supreme. To be well caring of mother, of father, to look after spouse and children, to engage in a harmless occupation, this is a blessing supreme. Outstanding behavior, blameless virtue, blameless action, open hands to all relatives, and selfless giving, this is a blessing supreme. To cease and abstain from evil, to avoid intoxicants, to be diligent in virtuous practices, this is a blessing supreme. To be reverent and humble, content and grateful, to hear the Dharma at the right time, this is a blessing supreme. To be patient and obedient, to visit with spiritual people, to discuss the Dharma at the right time, this is a blessing supreme. To live simply and purely, to see the noble truths and to realize freedom, is the blessing supreme. A mind unshaken when touched by the worldly states, sorrowless, stainless, and secure, this is a blessing supreme. Those who have fulfilled all these are everywhere invincible. They find well-being everywhere. This is the blessing supreme. Anicca vata sankara upaduva yodamino upakituva neruchanti tesang upasamo suko. All things are impermanent. They have the nature of arising and passing away. Bringing to peace all the activity of the mind is the greatest happiness. So may the this little remembrance of the dead, may Halloween, may your meditation practice in general, may your life all nurture and bring forth the goodness that's inside of each of you. And may that goodness that's in each of you be offered for the welfare and happiness of everyone that you encounter. May all beings everywhere be happy. So thank you very much. And I wish you all well and a happy Halloween.